Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 07-3022, United States of America versus Roger Art, Jr., Appellant. Mr. Axum for the appellant, Mr. Arado for the appellee.
May it please the court, Tony Axum representing Appellant Roger Arndt. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Arndt's primary challenge on appeal is to the district court's erroneous exclusion of evidence negating his specific intent for the charged crimes. He seeks reversal of the conviction and remand for a new trial. Although the district court in this case purported to evaluate Mr. Arndt's proffered evidence concerning expert testimony under Federal Rule of Evidence 702, it did not actually evaluate the scientific methods and principles of Mr. Arndt's expert's opinion as required under Rule 702. The district court also did not make any reliability findings concerning that opinion as required under Rule 702. Rather, the district court credited the government's proffer of facts concerning what Mr. Arndt did and what occurred in this case to decide that the expert's testimony was inconsistent with those facts and therefore inadmissible. The court's decision focused on the weight of the evidence rather than on the admissibility and amounted to a summary exclusion of defense evidence without an adequate basis. It was therefore an abuse of discretion for the district court to exclude the proffered evidence in this case.
Wasn't the district court here responding to the defense counsel's proffer? In other words, that's how the defense counsel explained the evidence. That is, that it would be first character evidence going to intent.
This defense counsel certainly explained it. There was a lack of clarity in the way defense counsel explained it.
Well, that's what I'm trying to get at, and that's all the court had to go on at that point, right?
At that point, however, counsel also submitted a written pleading identifying that he wished for his expert to testify about the intent or about the development of Mr. Arndt's psychological makeup and why that would tend to suggest that he did not have the specific intent in this case. The court certainly understood the evidence to be expert evidence and certainly understood what defense counsel and Mr. Arndt wanted to show with that evidence. If I could refer to my notes, I believe the court even noted at one point that at most this doctor would be able to come in and say he has got post-traumatic stress, he has got this, he has got that, and he has these problems because of these things that have happened to him. And I assume based on the testing that she has done, she could give an opinion as to what his psychological makeup is. I don't think defense counsel wanted any more than that. Certainly the rules would not have actually allowed any more than that. The court understood what the purpose of the testimony was and understood it as expert testimony. What the court failed to do is to analyze that under Rule 702. Instead, the court decided that the conclusion, the opinion, was inconsistent with the facts and that there would be no way that the testimony could be tailored or an instruction could be given. It's not even clear that the court considered limiting how the doctor would testify, the court essentially summarily excluded the testimony because the court itself was persuaded by the conclusion, and that is not what this court or Daubert v. Merrill pharmaceuticals, that's not the approach that should be taken under Rule 702. Rather, the approach that should be taken is to analyze the methods and principles and qualifications of the expert, a more process-oriented approach rather than the substantive question of the persuasiveness of the opinion, which is a question really for the jury. The proposed evidence here was relevant and would clearly assist the trier of fact. As this court noted in Childress, evidence of specific intent or evidence tending to negate specific intent in a criminal case where specific intent is an element of the offense is relevant. And
what was the evidence in that case?
In Childress?
Yes.
In a nutshell, it was that the defendant was had a diminished mental capacity. And
now, your defense here, your testimony here, was not going to diminish capacity, was it?
It was not diminished mental capacity,
right.
No. It was it was the doctor's analysis was that
Mr. decided that the apparent intent of somebody who traveled downtown after making arrangements to meet somebody downtown and went to the place they agreed to meet was not actually to meet them there, or, I mean?
No, I think that oversimplifies the doctor's opinion in this case, but it ignores what the government was required to prove. What the government was required to prove is that Mr. Arndt traveled with a specific intent to engage in sex with a minor, and it's not simply that he intended to travel, or that he intended to have sex, or that he intended to meet a minor. It's all three of those things, and her opinion spoke to all three of those things. Most specifically, it spoke to his attraction, I shouldn't say most specifically. It certainly spoke to his attraction to prepubescent children and suggested that he did not have an attraction to them. But it analyzed that through the prism of his post-traumatic stress, which I don't want to say made him more susceptible to the conversation that took place on the internet, but had him searching for something, some human contact, in a way that that was not readily apparent from the conversation and from his actions. And really, that's why her opinion was expert testimony. She explained in more detail in her report that Mr. Arndt's post-traumatic stress caused him to not be able to connect with people, and that in some ways he was living in a fantasy world as he chatted on the internet, and that he didn't fully comprehend his actions. And I don't think you can divorce out any single factor in her opinion, but certainly all of that tends to suggest that he did not have the intent. And I also don't want to debate the merits of her opinion. The merits of her opinion, while important, are not as important as the process that the district court was required to follow to decide whether to admit or exclude that opinion. Here, the district court didn't follow any process, didn't make any reliability findings, and for that reason, at a minimum, this case should be remanded for the district court to do that. I see that
Mr. Exum, in your brief, you take issue, change the subject a bit here, before I lose you. You took issue with the reasonableness of a sentence, saying it was greater than necessary to achieve the statutory purpose and so on. And at 46 in your brief, carrying over from 45 to 46, it says, neither Mr. Arndt's history and background nor the facts and circumstances of his case justified imposing a lifetime restriction on contact with anyone under the age of 18, not his own child. was that objection raised below?
There was no objection raised to that below.
So our standard is plain error?
Well, I don't agree that the standard is plain error. This supervised release was imposed at the last part of the sentence. That certainly wouldn't excuse defense counsel from raising an objection if he was supposed to, but the argument that the term of supervised release and the conditions are too severe is certainly an argument that goes to the severity of the sentence, the length of the sentence, which is not an objection that has to be raised at sentencing. Certainly objections of a procedural nature would have to be raised, but
an objection to the duration have to be raised?
Well, first and foremost is that a defendant always objects to a longer sentence or more severe conditions. I think
this is pretty specific, though, and a little bit unusual, at least in my experience, which is not all that great. In 22 years, I don't think I've seen more than one or two other cases involving, a prohibition on contact with children. But here you have in the sentence, prohibition on contact with children not his own. And it's not the duration of the, I don't think, maybe I'm misreading this. I didn't think it was the duration of that prohibition to which you're objecting, but to the nature of it.
I'm objecting to both. It is imposed for a lifetime, but it is certainly a condition of supervised release that is more severe than necessary to accomplish and a greater restriction on liberty than necessary to accomplish the statutory purposes of sentencing.
Well, without the benefit of an objection below, can you tell me now what exactly you are proposing? What would you ask for on remand?
First and foremost, I would ask for a basis for a nexus between this case and that restriction, the facts of this case.
That's not what you're being asked at this point. What would you ask the judge to do instead of what he did there?
Yeah.
If the judge, understanding that the judge would like to impose some restriction on contact with minors, I would ask for no unsupervised contact with minors. That would certainly be more reasonable. I still can't say that it would be reasonable for a lifetime.
Does the qualification unsupervised have a gloss on it? Is it in the guidelines or case law?
I believe that cases have interpreted unsupervised to mean that the defendant is alone without permission of a supervising adult.
So the term's been used before, but does it have its foundation in the guidelines or elsewhere?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Are there cases in this circuit?
There are not.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson.
May it please the court, Leslie Ann Gerardo on behalf of the United States. Given the posture in which the issue of the proposed testimony from the expert witness arose in this case, the district court did not abuse its discretion in concluding that it would not permit that testimony. As the court, I know, is aware, there was no pretrial disclosure as required by Rule 16 about the intent to offer this proposed expert testimony. The issue first arose when the prosecutor brought it to the trial court's attention, and in that context, the court was grappling with the question of whether or not this would even be a permissible legal theory. Given that posture, the court acted appropriately in exploring the...
To what extent is your position dependent upon it on the procedural lateness of the tender? Suppose...
I think the procedural posture helps, but I don't think it's dependent on that.
You seem to be stressing that now in a way you were not stressing it in the brief.
Well, for this reason, Your Honor, one of the things that defense counsel below and on appeal has completely ignored is the import of Rule 704. 704B was brought to the district court's attention, and that really on the merits pretty much governs this case. The proffer that was made was that the expert witness would testify that the appellant neither had or could have formed the intent to have sex with a minor, but that precise testimony would have been precluded by Rule 704.
Yeah.
So you're left then with this abstract testimony that he had post-traumatic stress disorder, he was addicted to the internet, he couldn't form interpersonal attachments easily, from which the jury would have been required to somehow extrapolate the lack of intent. And that ultimately was what the district court looked at in concluding that that testimony would simply not be helpful. And I think that was correct.
The light really is on Rule 704 and not on the failure to make an earlier proffer.
That's correct.
Right.
And that seems to be, unless the court has any other questions on that issue, I think that...
If this testimony had been allowed, would defense counsel have been able to argue to the jury? In other words, the court does at one point acknowledge that she would have been able to talk about his maladies, his diagnosis, and so forth. And if it had been limited in that way, would defense counsel have been able to make the connection, say, in his closing argument to intent?
I think that's an interesting question, Your Honor. And I think the question turns on whether it's a fair inference from the expert's opinions and diagnosis that somehow relates to intent. Quite frankly, I don't think so. I think the court could have properly said, that's just not a permissible inference because there's no connect between this diagnosis and the question of intent. Even if it had been permissible, however, it would have had such limited effect in this case because there was so much information that undercut the expert's opinion. Most notably, I think Judge Santel, you noted this earlier, that there's a missing piece here because all of her testimony really went to the context of the chat and how to interpret that and says nothing about the fact that he traveled into the district to actually meet with this minor. And in fact, the only information that she offered on this point when asked about it, I believe at sentencing, was, well, the defendant had explained to her that he didn't intend to go through with it, that he was going to tell the child to turn around. That just really has no real weight and would not have carried much weight with the jury. Even if there had been some limited use that could have been made from this and some small inference that could have been drawn, the lack of the evidence really did not harm the defense in this case.
I had one other question. In Childress, we said, even if this kind of evidence is potentially admissible and relevant to specific intent, it's up to the district court to determine whether that testimony is grounded in sufficient scientific support to warrant it being admitted. And here, the trial court ended up saying, this just seems like voodoo science to me. But counsel's point is, under 702, that's not enough. What's your response to that?
I think, and this is where the posture becomes more important, had it been raised in the correct procedural posture, had there been a Rule 16 disclosure, there might have been, and had a defendant requested it, which he didn't request here, there might have been a hearing of voir dire to further explore the scientific basis. The fault of that lies on the defense because of the way it was raised and because of the failure to ask for a more substantive hearing. That being said, I think the trial court was correct. If you look at the expert's report and you look at the proffer, it's very clear that this particular diagnosis was a very individualized diagnosis. It wasn't something that appeared to have been based on some broader theory. I mean, defense counsel repeatedly said she would testify about his unique standing and his unique psychological history, which is why he presented it initially as character evidence. So the scientific grounding, I think, is lacking, because this was really a defense that was structured around this individual person, as opposed to extrapolating from other cases involving other individuals who engaged in this kind of conduct. And I would point the court at sentencing, the district court specifically asked the expert, what was it about this defendant that made him unable to form the intent? And she really couldn't answer that question beyond saying he had post-traumatic stress disorder, he couldn't form interpersonal relationships. The court then came back and said, but I'm sure a lot of people have those problems, and they're still able to conform their conduct. And she agreed with that. So I think the problem here, and I think, quite frankly, it is the reason why it was presented initially as character evidence, is this really isn't scientific evidence. It was a sort of custom-crafted defense to meet this defendant. If the court has no further questions on that issue.
I have one about the sentencing. Yep. At 53 in your brief, you responded to the defendant's objection to the prohibition, to the restrictions in his sentence on contact with children not his own. And you say Dr. Brown's report recommended that appellant have no unsupervised contact with minors without the specific approval of his treating therapist and probation officer. The court ultimately imposed a prohibition that didn't have the unsupervised qualification on it.
That's correct.
Was that, you told us Dr. Brown's position. What was the government's position here?
I don't believe the government opined on that, Your Honor. I think that was...
Right, so Dr. Brown comes in and suggests no unsupervised contact. The government says nothing, and the court says no contact.
And the appellant says nothing.
The appellant says nothing.
Correct.
What I'm wondering is whether there's reason to think that that was a an unconsidered or ministerial omission.
I believe the district court, the court had the materials in front of it and knew the report was there and chose not to provide the unsupervised conduct, simply said no contact.
Court didn't comment on that.
That's correct.
So,
quite frankly, I don't know.
I'm wondering just what the breadth of that is. Does this mean he can't go to a restaurant that has 17-year-old people pouring water for him?
Or? Well, I think to the extent that there's a lack of clarity, he could certainly seek clarification from the court or from his probation officer. I'm not sure adding the word unsupervised would actually address that issue because, if you go somewhere, who's supervising, I think,
becomes... You use the term supervised in the broadest sense. You've got other adult persons present in that circumstance, so that if you're taking a broad look at it, I think perhaps that might solve some of the possible overbreadth problems of this sentence. So.
I think certainly he could seek clarification from the district court if it was unclear.
Well, isn't it unclear? I mean, you're saying if it's unclear, isn't it unclear? When I asked you if that'd be a violation, you didn't answer me. Telling me that what they could do instead.
I think there's certainly an intent element there. I mean, I think the fact that one goes out in public intercourse and contacts various people would not be a violation of the provision.
How
I think
do we
it would,
know that from the broad terms of that condition.
Well, I think there's always an inquiry into a defendant's mental state, and if he's not intentionally violating
how do we know
it,
that?
I think the facts and circumstances of any individual encounter would have to be examined.
Yeah, that would be a post hoc examination. How does the defendant know in order to conform his conduct to the condition? You're telling me about things you could do afterward, about the inquiry you could make, but how does the defendant know in advance how to conform his conduct to that broader condition?
Again, he could certainly seek guidance from the probation department or from the district court if he thinks that there's a lack of clarity.
How would he do that, a 60B motion?
I believe so, yes, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. If there are no further questions, we'll submit on the brief and ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
With regard to the Rule 16 disclosure, I would just note, as I noted in my reply, that the court gave every indication that it would continue this matter for the government to hire an expert or for further discussion of the expert if it decided that the expert was allowed to come in. So for the government to stand here and say that time was of the essence and that the late disclosure caused the court to make a hasty decision, and therefore, because the defendant was at fault for the late disclosure, the defendant should suffer, I think is disingenuous. But with regard to the question of a hearing and whether we certainly believe that the district court should have conducted a hearing, but the decision to proceed
a hearing
with regard to hear from the expert or to voir dire the expert or to place questions to the expert. Daubert envisions a process by which through cross-examination the expert's opinion is distilled and the court is it's clarified for the court so that the court can make a reliability determination. Here, the court chose to proceed based on the proffer of counsel and based on the report that the government notes is a 22-page comprehensive report. In the government's brief, it argued that the report itself was enough for the court to find that the expert was not reliable. It now says that the report spoke to something else, and now that the focus appears to be on the district court's failure to make any reliability finding whatsoever, and failure to actually consider what is contained in that report. And I'd note for the court, what is contained in that report is 15 separate bibliographical references, a complete CV with extensive training and expertise, and a battery of psychological tests that were performed, all scientific, all in my experience, generally accepted in the psychiatric and psychological community. So this is not voodoo science, as the district court suggested. The district court made a conclusion that the expert's opinion was not science.
We're that well over your time now, counsel. So
thank you.
Thank you.